CBSI in the World. I'm John Batchelor with Nick Loy, a reader in military and imperial history at King's College. His magnificent new storytelling is The History of the Great War, 1914 to 1918, on the Western Front, Belgium and France. You think of this as trench warfare. That was not the intention. However, it was the result of the opening stages of the war, and the French determined a deal of what was to happen in their defense of Paris. We begin with the commander of the French forces as the war opens. His name is Joffre. He is a man whom Nick describes as he does not panic. He did not panic. What do we need to know about Joffre, how his vision of the war took place, Nick?
Yes, I mean, he's one of the great heroes of the Western Front, one of the great heroes of the French army. I know he's memorably described in Barbara Tuchman's Guns of August that you may have read. He's a figure that in some ways is quite unimpressive. He's an engineer. He's not taught at the staff college, or he's not produced works of great military merit. But he has a kind of earthiness and a connection to the army that I think is really important in 1914, as whereas under the shock of war, Helmuth von Moltke, the German commander, collapses, essentially just can't take the pressure. Joffre can, and he is able to do what he can to defeat the Schlieffen Plan and the German invasion and counterattack at the Marne River in September 1914. And Joffre's ability to essentially absorb punishment, but to keep an eye through all the chaos of war, he just understands what is going on and he's able to react quickly. And I think that's what marks him out for greatness, certainly in 1914, is this ability not to lose his head, not to become too discouraged, to keep playing the game, keep moving his units, try to outflank the enemy, and ultimately that ability to just to have that sort of gravitas is really important. Again, Joffre is not particularly charismatic in that sense, but he is a really solid commander. And I think that is something that sometimes we overlook. And that's why Joffre is such a compelling figure in many ways, because he just keeps his head. He keeps his nerve. And if you look at the way he actually fights, I think it's very impressive in many ways.
Well, politics in France was everything during the war, in constant conversation, because Paris is 50, 100 miles from the battlefield and is often the target through the war of German raids, German bombs. So Poincaré, Raymond Nicolas Landry Poincaré, president of the French Republic, 1913 to 1920. There'll be a series of ministers who come and go, but Poincaré is always there, and he's heavily involved in the military analysis and war meetings in 16 and 17. What do we need to know about him? Was he what we would today call bellicose, or was he looking for political solutions, Nick?
I think, well, he's a nationalist and he believes greatly in France's mission, France's greatness. But I think what you see in certainly the first half of the war in France is that sort of realization that, you know, they have not won. They might not have been defeated, but they have come close. And moreover, that they need to do things differently. They need to remobilize. They need to, also from a political perspective, they need to start to claw Joffre in, because essentially for the first 4 months of the war, Joffre is basically almost a dictator. Almost every decision related to that war goes through him. And the politicians have gone to Bordeaux and they come back and they try and rein him in and try and reassert political primacy over the army. So the political situation in France is, I think, really key to understanding how the French army fights. And, you know, that pressure is constant on her commanders in terms of, you know, trying to re-equip the army, trying to attack and defeat the Germans, but also trying to bring the British in where, and continually try to get the British to commit more and more manpower to the Western Front. Of course, Poincaré is at the heart of all of that. And, you know, at the same time is they're having to deal with the situation that, you know, a significant slice of France is now under German occupation.
There are two generals who will emerge in the course of the battles of 15 and 16, Pétain and Foch, and we'll come to them, but a man who can be lost because he was momentarily the commander of all the forces once Joffre stepped aside in December of 16, is Nivelle, a complete surprise to me. He was an artillery officer who, I believe, Joffre spotted him, identified him as a man of the future. But Nivelle was a great disappointment and almost wrecked the whole French army. Why?
Well, no, that's a great question. And Nivelle is one of the characters I found one of the most interesting characters I was writing about in the book, because Joffre, you know, is a hero of 1914, but as the war carries on and, you know, he's not able to break through in 1915 or 1916, his reputation begins to become somewhat tarnished and he becomes somewhat tired. And as the fighting in 1916 goes on, there's a second army commander at Verdun, as you say, an artilleryman, called Robert Nivelle. And people start looking at him and thinking, this is someone special. And he has an ability to use artillery. He uses creeping barrages. He uses different techniques. He's quite a good soldier and he's able to get results. He recaptures Fort Douaumont, which is one of the most important fort in the Verdun fortress system. It becomes a symbol of French resistance. So Nivelle becomes this great battlefield hero. And I think at a time where France is weakening, you know, they've lost heart, they've lost so many people, they failed to break through in 15 and most of 16, and they suffer terribly at places like Verdun. The French government just think that Nivelle is, you know, he ascends very quickly. He rises really, really quickly, because he just seemed to have the magic touch. And so, of course, he replaces Joffre. Joffre is essentially kicked up stairs and given a very high-sounding but ultimately somewhat impotent position. And Nivelle commands the armies. And Nivelle wants to attack. He wants to break through, which they try in the spring of 17 in the so-called Nivelle Offensive, which fails. But Nivelle ultimately is good at one level. He's a good corps commander and army commander. He's good in actually orchestrating relatively small scale operations. He is promoted way above his means. And as essentially a commander in chief, he tries to repeat what he's done at a lower level. And that doesn't really work because you don't have the amount of guns that he had. You don't have the organization. You don't have the training. So it just doesn't really work. So Nivelle is quite a compelling character. A lot of politicians, certainly British politicians, found him quite a engaging character. They found him he could speak fluent English. So they were naturally drawn to him. But ultimately, he's a great disappointment. And I think that's one of the great, you know, tragedies of the Western Front is it can find you out. War can find you out. If you don't really know what you're doing, if you get out of your depth, as happened to Nivelle, then disaster can happen quite quickly. So, yeah, Nivelle is a really interesting character. Actually quite little known, really.
Yes, it was a surprise to me, Nick. So we go to the man who replaces Nivelle, Pétain, but you introduce Pétain at Verdun, staring out a window at the troops going up in the morning and dragging themselves in pieces coming back in the afternoon. Is there the poet in French generals, Nick? You've read their archives. Do they compete with each other with poetic language?
Now, that's a really interesting point. I think, you know, some of them do. I think some of them have a way of sort of seeing it in a more lyrical sense than perhaps, you know, other generals. Maybe some of the British generals are somewhat dry. So Douglas Haig's diary is quite dry. But someone like Pétain is quite obviously a deep, you know, an extremely intelligent individual and clearly feels it. And that is, I think, one of the outstanding qualities of Pétain. He's a man who's deeply in touch with what is possible and what is not possible on the battlefield. And I think that's what marks him out for greatness in 1916 and 1917. He understands and he has that deep connection with those troops, what they're going through. And he will never, you know, very, very rarely will he send them into a situation that they won't be able to deal with. So I think that's part of the reason why he becomes a sort of savior of France in a way. And I think he's not particularly young when the war starts. He's a sort of passed over colonel, but he rises very, very quickly to become commander-in-chief of the French army. And he shows a great surety and a great calmness and he knows what he needs to do and he does it very well, very, very well. So I think he is one of those great commanders. And, you know, obviously, things change in the Vichy regime in the Second World War, but in the First World War, there's no doubting Pétain's ability and his important role in keeping the French army going. through that long war.
The Supreme Allied Commander of April 1918, Marshal Foch, you very much present Foch's plan to end the war. However, I first meet Foch in your explication because he was involved in holding the line, I believe, in France in 1914. Wasn't he part, I've written down here, the 20th Corps was part of the defense of Paris. So he takes some time to become Supreme Commander. Is he regarded today as the man who effectively in those last 100 days did what nobody else could do using the Canadian forces and the Americans? Is that reputation still standing up, Nick?
I think it is. And I think, you know, Pétain and Foch are quite different individuals, but they're both great commanders in their own way. And I think there's no doubt that Foch is largely regarded as one of the most important, you know, generals that war throws up. He is on the Western Front from 1914, and he's still there in 1918. And he goes through a few ups and downs. He commands a corps in 1914 and becomes, you know, seen as a commander of great skill. And eventually he is, he becomes an army commander. He becomes an army group commander. Eventually falls out with Joffre because he's somewhat, you know, they don't see eye to eye on, you know, how you should fight, because this is up for debate all the time. And then in 1918, when the Allies are faced with perhaps separation and defeat from the German spring offensive, Foch steps in and becomes what they call a generalissimo, a sort of supreme Allied commander. And Foch's great qualities are his, again, he understands what can and can't be done on the battlefield. And he's never discouraged, whereas Pétain's sort of care and attention on his men, by 1918, this has sort of dragged him down a little bit, where he really doesn't have too much fighting spirit left because he's so focused on just dragging his army to the end. Foch is, he's like a sort of bouncy ball. He's up and, you know, he's much more energetic character. He's much more charismatic. The British like him. The Americans like him. He's a hero in America. And he becomes a sort of symbol of Allied resistance. So Foch is one of those great commanders. And I think his, you know, recent decades, historians have looked again at Foch and have, you know, I think showed him in a very good light as one of those commanders who is able to coordinate all those different elements, the Americans, the British, the French, all those elements in 1918 in a fully multinational war to victory. So there's no doubting, I think Foch's reputation is probably only going to get stronger as the years go on. He is one of the great characters of the war.
I read him as the Eisenhower of the First War, the man who could pull together all the technology with the personalities and make them work in those last weeks. We're going to turn to the British and the British politics of the war. The book is The Western Front. Nick Lloyd is the author. History of the Great War, 1914 to 1918. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.